You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a state program says that if a person is unmarried and gives birth while receiving Medicaid, the state can get back some of the costs of the birth from the father of the child. We'll get into the details and the arguments for and against that policy. Now, the First Step Act was signed into federal law late last year, making significant changes to parts of the criminal justice system. The legislation had support from lawmakers and advocates on both sides of the aisle, and President Trump hailed it as a bipartisan achievement during his State of the Union address last week.
This legislation reformed sentencing laws that have wrongly and disproportionately harmed the African-American community. The First Step Act gives nonviolent offenders the chance to re-enter society as productive, law-abiding citizens. Now, states across the country are following our lead.
Aisha Roscoe is a White House reporter for National Public Radio. She's visiting Wisconsin this week and joins us in the studio. Aisha, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, back in December, President Trump signed this First Step Act that had passed through Congress. Can you give us the basics on what changed under this law?
So there are kind of two main components of this. And so one part focused on people who are already incarcerated and basically giving them incentives to get involved in programs and rehabilitation and basically giving them credits that would allow them to kind of take some time off of their sentence in prison. Basically, they would be able to do supervised release in a halfway house or even at home under supervised release. And then also, the other big part of it is the sentencing reform. And so under that, what you have is, if you've heard of the three strikes and you're out law, so instead of a third strike, you getting a life sentence, that's down to 25 years in prison. And then also, there is there was a change a few years back in the disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, but that wasn't retroactive. And so what this law did, the First Step Act, it made it retroactive. So if you basically were convicted on a crack offense before this law was passed, you can petition to the court and basically ask for a change or a reduction in your sentence.
Now, you've been following the politics of this,
yes.
And it wasn't that long ago that the bipartisan consensus was tough on crime, longer sentences. Republicans maybe pushed that more, but Democrats were right on board, mm-hmm. too. What has been changing that both parties are saying, okay, hey, maybe we went too far here?
Well, it seemed like this was kind of a long time building, and it started, obviously, there were people on the left who were concerned about the war on drugs, but then you had this kind of movement on the right where they became concerned that we're locking up all these people, but we're not really lowering crime, and we're wasting taxpayer dollars by having all these people locked up and kind of wasting potential by having all these people who could be out here working and adding to the economy. Instead, they're locked up. And so you had groups like the Koch brothers and the Heritage Foundation who started saying, look, this isn't really the best way to go about the mass incarceration is not really great policy. And so, of course, you had people on the left who really agreed with that.
We've seen a lot of cases where, especially in the Senate, in the House too, I guess, Republican leadership would say, we're not going to take a vote on something if the president isn't going to sign it. Talk about President Trump's role in supporting this legislation.
Yeah, so obviously the president is always important in getting legislation through, but in this case, you really wouldn't have had Republicans sticking out their neck and saying, we support this, if they felt like President Trump would not back this, or even worse, if he would say, look, this is soft on crime. You don't want to be that Republican. But in this case, what you had was someone in the White House very close to President Trump, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law and top advisor, was supportive of doing something on criminal justice reform. And so he was able to kind of advocate personally and work behind the scenes in the White House to build that support to get President Trump on board.
We're talking to Aisha Roscoe from NPR News, looking at sentencing reform at the federal level. What kind of limits are there here? Are people saying, okay, nice, but not far enough?
There are people who feel like this didn't go far enough. So first of all, when I talked about helping the prisoners and giving them incentives, that only applies to certain prisoners. So there were a lot of exclusions. If you were deemed violent, obviously like sexual offenders, fentanyl traffickers. And there were so basically a lot of people were excluded from that program. And so some argue that that's really not helpful, and that even if you committed a serious crime, you're the one that needs the most help. You know, you're the one that needs the most rehabilitation, because eventually you're going to be getting out of prison. This also doesn't help those who aren't getting out of prison, those who don't, who have life. And there are a lot of even sometimes first time offenders and nonviolent offenders who have life for drug offenses. And so this doesn't help those people. And so that's where some of the concern is.
And this is federal legislation applying to federal prisoners, right?
Yes. And so, and I should be very clear here that most people who are in prison are not locked up at the federal level. Most of it is at the state level. So that's also another limitation.
Is there a sense, though, that, okay, hey, if the federal government does this, if I'm a state lawmaker, maybe it's time to review what we're doing here in the state?
Yes, and you are seeing some of that. You're seeing after the passage of the First Step Act, you're seeing some states kind of trying to have their own version of the First Step Act. And I should say that it was states that really led this movement. You had kind of the Texas miracle they talked about. They talk about a lot where they made changes to the way they were set up their prisons and things of that nature. And so states were kind of leading the way. But now that the federal government has acted, you see other states trying to get involved as well.
Was there pushback in Congress saying, no, this goes too far, this is too soft on crime?
You definitely had Republican senators like Tom Cotton, who to this day, he opposed this, and he to this day says that he feels like they're letting people out of jail who are basically criminals and violent, and that this is going to lead to a crime spree in America, and he wants this to be rolled back. And you had other people who were not supportive of this, like Ben Sasse, I think, to a Republican senator, Marco Rubio, was not supportive of this. You had people who felt like this had the potential to let people out sooner than they should be, or to no one wants to be that person who approved a law and someone gets out and then they do something bad while they're out. And they don't want that. They don't want to have to live with that. And so you do have those people who feel like it went too far.
With these laws in place, is this something that happens automatically to people in the categories you mentioned, or is there some discretion from the federal government that has to sign off basically on anything that changes?
So you have what is supposed to happen, and this is a big part of the implementation, is that the Bureau of Prisons is supposed to come up with a risk assessment tool that would basically categorize every prisoner who comes in and say, okay, your minimum risk, your medium risk, your high risk. And so the high risk people are not going to have the same incentives, and they're not going to be allowed to go into supervised release under these programs. And so it's really supposed to be focused on the minimum risk and kind of lower risk people. And you can, I guess, petition during your time in prison to go from high risk to lower risk. But there, a lot of this is going to hinge on development of this kind of tool, this algorithm that will look at different factors about a person and decide what is their risk level for recidivism.
All right, this federal law now, this First Step Act is law. You've got this weird coalition of people on the left, on the right. Are they clapping their hands together saying, okay, we're done? Or what are they looking for next?
So, no, this is supposed to be a first step. It's not supposed to be the last word on this. And so a big thing that they're going to be looking at is what I just talked about, was that implementation. They want to make sure that the Bureau of Prisons follows through on developing these programs, on developing that risk assessment tool, and that people are actually being able to take advantage of this stuff. But beyond that, there's also talk about maybe somehow on the federal level providing incentives to states to change the way they do bail, because that is a huge issue where you have people locked up who haven't even been convicted because they just can't afford to make bail. And so you end up having people incarcerated before they're even convicted. And basically, it's kind of like a debtor's prison. So that's another thing that people want to work on.
As we wrap up, are you seeing a push to pass some more legislation in Congress now, or, you know, with another shutdown maybe just around the corner, is this all by the wayside now?
Well, there is some, there are some bills that people are kind of working on and floating around. And even we talked about the crack cocaine, the changes there. Some people want to do more when it comes to marijuana and to people that are in prison for marijuana, especially when you have some states legalizing it. So there is some work on it. Now, it's not kind of front burner right now, but there is some kind of work building to see what can they do next.
Ayesha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ayesha Roscoe is a White House reporter for NPR. She's in Wisconsin this week and stopped by to talk with us about what's happening with criminal justice reform at the federal level. Coming up, we'll talk about the state's birth cost recovery program, which holds some fathers responsible for medical costs of their child's birth if it was paid for by Medicaid. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a project from Bloomberg Health News spent a year reporting on Americans risking it and going without health insurance. One of the reporters shares their stories. First, a legislative study committee met today to discuss changes to the state's birth cost recovery program. The details are a little complicated. Basically, if a pregnant woman is not married and is on Medicaid when she gives birth, the state can ask for the alleged father to pay back some of the costs of the birth to the state Medicaid program or to the county. Supporters of the program say it gives critical funding to local child support agencies, but opponents, including our next guest, call it a birth tax and argue it hurts minority communities. Bobby Peterson is the executive director for ABC for Health. He testified against this program today at the Capitol. Bobby, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, Bobby, I gave kind of a nutshell description of how this works. Flesh it out a little more for us. What is this birth cost recovery program?
Well, it's basically a program that's unique in Wisconsin, and not a lot of other states do it. There's only a handful of other states that have a program like this, but basically it draws a distinction between married and unmarried parents that are on the Medicaid program. If you're an unmarried pregnant woman, you are required to go through a process to identify the absent father, and that father then is subpoenaed to court to potentially repay the part of the birth costs for that baby. Our issue with it and the reason it's birth tax is it's applied really only to unmarried parents, and it also creates a major stress point for women as they apply for Badger Care or Medicaid. And we know, and the research is very clear on this, that prenatal stress has a very, very detrimental effect on birth outcomes. Wisconsin has the highest infant mortality rate for African-American babies in the country. We're not saying that birth cost recovery is the cause, but it's something we could do something about to eliminate some of that prenatal stress. It has a huge impact on minority communities, low-income communities. 20,000 births annually across the state are to single women. And we've learned a long time ago that trying to make sure that we have appropriate access, unhindered access to prenatal care for pregnant women is the best way to go forward, the best way to promote positive birth outcomes. Putting hoops and hurdles in the path of pregnant women to identify absent parents creates a lot of stress and can result in poor birth outcomes.
Is part of the thinking here that if this is a married couple we're talking about, then their finances are both considered in terms of eligibility for Medicaid, for Badger Care, whereas if they're not married, I guess it's an out, it's a way to, sneak into eligibility?
Yeah, but it's really eligibility for the mom and the baby, and that's a priority. I mean, a long time ago we made the decision that all children should have access to free and appropriate public education because it was best for society. It was going to save us money in the long run to get kids access to school and education. I mean, the same thing is at play here with access to health care. Don't put barriers in the path of women that need to get prenatal care. Don't create a stressful environment for them and their partners. I mean, we're all about making sure that fathers are responsible and take care of their children. We think it's important that fathers are active, engaged with their children. But if the first action is a subpoena to court to repay birth costs, just simply because you're not married, that's a problem. Today, the committee was looking at changing some rules. We had made some headway in saying at least if a couple is unmarried but living together, so the father's living in the household, supporting the child, contributing to all the expenses, birth cost recovery would be inappropriate. But the child support agencies are really, I think, pushing this because they're taking a bit of a hit. They're not getting as much revenue. They get a county bounty on all the money that they collect. That's a heck of a way to run a child support office in some ways. It's off the backs of low-income families, and it's not insignificant. It's, you know, tens of millions of dollars. So it's a lot of money, but it's mostly drawn from low-income communities. County child support offices are acting as bill collectors.
Yeah, we saw a release from the Waukesha County Executive's Office making the case that, yeah, we, the county, are taking a hit from that that exemption you mentioned, Bobby, and wanting to reverse it, saying it's hurting our ability to provide child services and fund health programs.
Yeah, and I don't buy that. I mean, I think that this would, you know, it's a most of the states out there don't do this. Minnesota used to do it, but they decided it's not in the best interest of the child or the family. State after state has ended the practice. There's a few outliers, Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, a few others, but Wisconsin leads the pack in aggressive actions against low-income families, you know, that aren't married. And it has a bad outcome. It has a bad outcome with birth. It has a bad outcome for driving fathers away from families. It's just a move in the wrong direction. And I think we could do so much better by trying to bring families together, and so could child support offices, instead of acting like collection agencies for birth costs.
Bobby Peterson is with us, Executive Director for ABC for Health, talking about the state's birth cost recovery program, where when women give birth and it's paid for by Medicaid, counties and child support agencies can go to the father of the child to get back at least some of the expenses. Bobby, would you like to see just a different funding model to take away this birth cost recovery program and have, I don't know, the state make up the difference for these child service agencies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'd like to see Wisconsin conform to what most of the rest of the country is doing. There were committees that met way back in 2000, and even when Tommy Thompson was Secretary of Health and Human Services, that really identified this practice as being a barrier to prenatal care services, that it causes too much of a block for young women to get the prenatal care they need. Women are sanctioned in Wisconsin after 60 days on the program. They're kicked off if they don't identify the father. It just creates a real stressful situation for families, for neighborhoods. You know, people know what the score is. They know that, you know, as soon as a pregnant woman applies for Badger Care Plus, she's going to have to identify the absent parent, and it's going to cause stress. It could cause physical, emotional abuse, and other problems. It's just not worth it. Most states have moved on from this, and Wisconsin should too.
Is this a concern that maybe that pregnant woman just skips the prenatal care outright because of these concerns?
And we've had anecdotal stories of that. We've had stories from Milwaukee where women have shown up at the emergency room to deliver no prenatal care. It's a terrible situation. You know, you have a conflict here in Milwaukee between the Milwaukee Health Department that says we should end the practice and the Child Support Office that wants to expand it and increase it. It's really a you know, public policy just, you know, working against each other. We're really on the side of public health here, saying it is not worth it. It's not worth it to delay or defer prenatal care. It's not worth it to sanction women to put them through this stress. Through childbirth and having a young child and having to deal with being sanctioned and being kicked off the program, we can do so much better by proactively helping people maintain coverage, secure prenatal care, work with fathers, make sure that they're responsible and liable for their child support obligations, which this is not. Birth cost recovery is a different process. That's why we call it a birth tax. And, you know, support the families better. And it's definitely possible. A lot of the other states are doing it. Wisconsin is just really lagging behind.
Now, this legislative committee today is talking about moving things in the opposite direction of where you want to go, of ending some exemptions here. Have there been pushes in the legislature to get rid of this birth cost recovery program altogether?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been some discussions going on. I think there's some legislators that are saying, could we do it differently? You know, part of this process for families is that you need to identify what support is being provided to to the child. What support is the father providing? Is the father living in the household? Then absolutely not. Is the father providing some placement in custody? Is the father's family helping to do care and daycare and things like that as well? There's a whole lot of factors. Most of these dads get a judgment in the mail or a summons in the mail. Judgment is entered against them. They never even show up in court. They're not represented by attorneys because there's just no funding out there to support that. And so it's a bit of a kangaroo court. They get run through the ringer. Wages get garnished. Taxes get intercepted. Drives them deeper into poverty. And it's really the wrong direction to go.
Now, I got to admit, Bobby, I hadn't heard of this program until we talked about it today. Is this something that's really been flying under the radar?
Absolutely. It's one of many programs that flies under the radar in Wisconsin. And, you know, we represent people. We represent families. We dig to try and figure out what's going on here. This is something we discovered some years ago, and we've been advocating for it for a while. But it's a bad, you know, we had a research report that was done back in 2012 that showed that Wisconsin is one of the few states that applies this law. And it looks to us like this program is support for child support offices. It's not support for families.
We'll leave it there for now. Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be a part of it.
That's Bobby Peterson, executive director of the advocacy group ABC for Health. He was with us today to talk about a state program that leaves unmarried fathers on the hook for some of the medical bills of their child's birth if it was covered by Medicaid. A legislative committee met today looking at the possibility of putting more people in effect under that program, getting rid of some exemptions that currently exist. Coming up, we'll check in with Bloomberg's year-long reporting project on life without health insurance. It's called Risking It, and you can get into the conversation right now. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Have you chosen or in some way been forced to go without health insurance? How do you try to meet your health care needs, if so, if you don't have coverage? Again, email ideas@wpr.org, or you can call in after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, the government shutdown just ended a few weeks ago. It might start up again real soon. Kate Archer Kent and her guests look at the latest negotiation efforts to pass a spending bill that includes something about the U.S.-Mexico border. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there's a growing number of Americans going without health insurance. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, more than 500,000 more people did not have health insurance in 2017, marking the first time the number of uninsured Americans grew since the Affordable Care Act was implemented. Last year, Bloomberg Health News kicked off a year-long reporting project looking into the experiences of uninsured Americans called Risking It, Stories from America's Uninsured. Drew Armstrong leads the U.S. Health News team for Bloomberg News. Drew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you guys for having me back.
Well, we talked to you about a year ago when you were kicking off this project. Remind us about what you were hoping to find out.
So we really wanted to, about 5 years since the Affordable Care Act began, really expanding coverage to millions and millions of people, take a look at that program, how it was working or wasn't working, and really dig deep into the lives of the people who had said, you know, we wanted to be insured, we think this is the best thing for a family, but for one reason or another, we can't do it. And we spent our time focusing on people who are pretty firmly middle class and have, you know, aspirations to provide a better life for their kids. They make decent salaries. I mean, these are not kind of the poorest of the poor that I think a lot of people think about when they think about the uninsured. These are very, very standard middle class incomes of people who you would think would be wealthy enough to afford this kind of thing. And for one reason or another, they weren't able to, and they were making very serious, well-considered financial decisions about what they were going to have to squeeze out. And often, healthcare was that thing.
Right. The stories you guys share, these are not just frivolous decisions. People are really weighing the pros and cons, the costs of healthcare, the deductibles, which we'll get into in a minute, and ultimately coming to this conclusion that they might be better off without healthcare, a coverage, I should say.
I think that no one thought that they would necessarily be better off. This was more a choice of saying, you know, we have four needs or something like that. We have to put a roof over our head. We have to feed our kids. We have to pay college tuition. And we have to pay cars, you know, car payments so we can get to work. And we have to buy healthcare insurance. But the reality is that even though these people might make, you know, $75,000 a year as a family of four, they can't afford one of those things. And they had to make a very, very big decision. And the reason we called risking it was because they knew the decision that they were taking was risky. They knew that they were exposing themselves to potentially catastrophic financial and health outcomes by doing this. And yet, when they looked at everything they had to do, they felt like this was the one thing that wasn't going to mean not having a car, not having a house, not being able to send their kids to college. And they said, we're going to have to chance it. We don't have any other options.
Let's get into some of the reasons that put people in these positions. One of them, and you spent a lot of time in a piece on this, high deductibles. Talk about how that's affecting people.
Yeah, this is something that was through and through, we kept hearing over and over again. And one thing to know about our story was that when we started this project, we'd identified about a dozen families across the U.S. And we ran our first story and we asked people to write in and tell us about themselves and say, hey, if you don't have insurance as well, or you've had to make this tough decision or been faced with this, we want to hear from you. And we gave people a form that they could fill out. And we thought, you know, I'll be totally honest. I was the editor on this story. And I thought, okay, maybe, you know, 50 or 100 people will write in. We had 5,000 people who wrote us very thoughtful, considered responses, shared their lives with us, and actually ended up being the basis for a much, much wider project than we had originally anticipated. And one of the things that came through with a lot of those people were people actually were insured, but they were in insurance plans that required them to pay anywhere from, you know, $1,000 to $10,000 out of pocket before their coverage kicked in. And that's in addition to the, you know, perhaps $500 or $600 or $1,000 a month they were already paying in premiums. So you're really looking at, when you get to the end of the year, you're looking at families that were paying $20,000 a year in some cases before they actually had any benefit from insurance. And what we found in talking to these people was you would see people who they had insurance. They had done what they thought was the right thing. They maybe even put a little bit of money aside. And at the same time, they had had a major health event and found, you know, that they were owing $8,000 in medical bills and having to pay those medical bills while also trying to keep up their insurance premiums. And, you know, you'd look at the economic statistics in this country and you see something along the lines of like 40% of people in the United States, they don't have the cash set aside to deal with a $400 emergency without having to sell something or borrow money from friends. There's a really severe burden that you put on people when you ask them to pay that much out of pocket. And exactly that happens when people need to go and pick up drugs for an illness. Let's say they get in a car accident, you know, and they're injured and they need to get an MRI. That number in that deductible adds up very, very, very fast and can be a sudden, shocking expense for people who thought that they were protected.
And under a lot of employer-based healthcare, I learned from your series, a lot of employers move to a high deductible plan, the idea being, okay, it'll make people think carefully. They won't frivolously go get health care they don't need. They'll only use it when they need it. People are finding that isn't working as they had hoped.
Yeah, I think there was an idea in the early 2000s that we would introduce the idea of shopping, the power of the consumer, and that would solve all these problems in healthcare. But anybody who's ever had to deal with a healthcare problem or has been taken away in an ambulance knows that you don't have a whole lot of power to shop for anything when you are bleeding or you're unconscious or you've been in a hospital or you've been you're in an ambulance. You're not talking to the EMTs and saying, well, hey, what are the rates on a CT scan at the hospital across town that's going to take 20 minutes further for me to get to? I mean, no one does that. You're asking people to apply rational, you know, consumer behavior to a situation where it's impossible to make a rational decision. And yet, we have seen employers for years and years start to put people into these plans. And, you know, while the justification behind it is saying, oh, we'll shop, it'll lower healthcare costs, the reality is they're just cheaper for employers to do. It is a way of cutting down the upfront premium that an employer has to pay and that often an employee is asked to pay a part of, instead of just, you know, and pushing that cost then onto the patient when they get injured. And so what you end up having is now that we've got about 40% of people, I think it's 39% of employers offer high deductible plans, you see all of these people who, you know, again, they have insurance, they've kind of done everything that they've been asked to, and all of a sudden they're hit with a sudden $1,000 expense. I think, you know, and often just for receiving routine care. I mean, this is for people who have chronic conditions and they get to the beginning of their deductible and all of a sudden it's like, gosh, I got to go fill my prescriptions and I'm just paying $1,000 out of pocket. This isn't something that they have the ability to necessarily do a lot of shopping or be thoughtful or stay healthier. We're kind of just hitting people with this money and asking them to deal with it. I think you're starting to see a little bit of a backlash to that now. You're seeing some large employers say, wait a second, this isn't working the way that we thought it would. Is there a way to be more sophisticated and ask people to shop for things that maybe they could shop for and not really nail people when they're in a situation where they don't really have the ability to make a choice or they're taking preventative primary care medicines where no matter what, they're going to need those things. You're starting to see employers reconsider these type of insurance plan designs.
Talking to Drew Armstrong from the Health News team at Bloomberg News, talking about their series on people who for one reason or another have had to go without insurance. It's called Risking It, Stories from America's Uninsured. Some of the painful decisions your team wrote about, Drew, were people having to decide, okay, which family member can have coverage or how often can we have coverage? How can we cobble something together? Can you talk about some of the solutions people came up with?
Yeah, we spent a ton of time with a family down in Texas, just outside Dallas, the Maldonados. David is the father. Maribel is his wife. They have a son, Christian, and a daughter, Alexa. The two kids are college age and are both in college when we were reporting on them. And David really, I mean, this family is a lot of ways the American dream. They make about $100,000 a year. He has a very successful job as a salesman, I believe, for construction equipment. The job provided health care insurance for him and his family. I mean, he is originally from Mexico and a legal immigrant, if I have this correct. One of the families is, and the other one has their background there. I mean, these are very much, you know, classic American, you know, several generations back immigrant story, doing their best. They're living in a middle-class suburb outside of Dallas. In 2012, he was still working for the construction company where he was working. His wife, Maribel, got breast cancer, and she was diagnosed, and they had health insurance. And he said, you know what, our lives fell apart, but we had health insurance. And she was able to get treatment and get taken care of. 2 years after that, his job came to every employee there and said, we've got some good news. You all still have your jobs, but the bad news is we cannot afford to provide you guys health care insurance anymore. And he was going to have to go from paying $260 a month, which was his contribution to get coverage for his family, up to almost $1,400. And they did everything they could. They took out loans to be able to keep their kids in college and to help pay for premiums. But ultimately, this got to a point where they could no longer afford it. They were looking at premiums of $1,600 a month, and they started to decide who is the least likely person in our family to get sick and who can afford to drop off health insurance. And David and the son, Christian, they were the first ones to go. And then Alexa, who was suffering from asthma but was in college, they took her off next, and they have put all their healthcare dollars into keeping Maribel on health insurance to keep an eye on her cancer.
We're talking to Drew Armstrong, part of the U.S. Health News team for Bloomberg News, about their series called Risking It, Stories from America's Uninsured. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been in this situation, having to calculate if you can afford to continue to get health insurance? What kind of decisions did you make if you are uninsured? Are you just hoping for the best? Are you cobbling something together, some kind of safety net? Call and share your story or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Drew Armstrong from Bloomberg News, talking about a project there, Risking It, about Americans without health insurance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had to go without health insurance? Why? How is that for you? How much stress is there in your life because of that? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Brown Deer. Mike, hello.
Hi. I just recently moved back here from North Carolina, but I was in the position where I had an employer-based plan. The employer went bankrupt. I ended up working for a company that didn't offer a health care plan. And at the time, I was able to buy a Blue Cross Blue Shield. It had a high deductible. I think it was $10,000 for the family. But I was able to pay for that for about $330 a month. And that had a $25 copay and low prescription rates and everything like that. After the Affordable Care Act, I was no longer able to buy a plan that inexpensive. It jumped to about $800 a month. When I got into an employee-based plan, I was basically paying about the same amount of money through an employee-based plan out of my paycheck. So we just opted out of it. And in North Carolina, they had kind of some of these little clinics called Fast Meds and stuff like that around, and they just had $75 copays. You could go in, get treated, get antibiotics, sometimes for free, and that just seemed to be the better alternative. And I was a dad and a wife and two kids, ages 10 years old to 14 years old, for about a year and a half. We had to do that just because we couldn't afford to be on the health care when it changed to the Affordable Care Act. And I was making about $74,000 a year.
Mike, thanks a lot for sharing your story. A couple things there, Drew. First of all, the Affordable Care Act expanded coverage for a lot of lower income people. Was it common for people in Mike's position making too much to maybe participate in the Affordable Care Act exchanges, seeing their costs go up?
Yeah, this was really a lot of the core group that we heard from. If you were at a lower income level, you were probably getting subsidies that were really helping with your purchase of insurance. And the coverage gains in those groups have been pretty good, and people seem to be generally happy with it. Once you start to get up into the middle class band, you know, above $75,000, close to $100,000, those subsidies drop away. And at the same time, one of the things that has happened on the Affordable Care Act markets is that the quality of the coverage in some ways from a does it cover quite a bit and does it cover all these benefits and things like that is very good, but it's also correspondingly more expensive. And again, if you're getting a subsidy, that may not matter as much to you. But people like your caller who might not be getting a subsidy, those people are really, really, really feeling the pinch in cases like this because they are being forced to pay those flat out rates that, again, you know, they're not getting any financial help from this, and they're looking at plans that really are not going to be, or they may be too expensive for them to afford and still come with a big deductible and things like that. What your caller did, you know, talking about going into a primary care clinic, that is how a lot of people are coping with this. They're doing what we refer to as kind of patching together a plan. They're saying, I'm going to buy my way into a primary care physician practice where I'll pay a couple hundred dollars a month. They let me go to see them as much as I need to. It takes care of basic stuff. If I get sick with a cold or something like that, that's not an emergency room. You know, it's not where you can go if you have cancer or you're bleeding and it won't stop. But it does let you see a doctor. And then the other things people will do, they'll join these things called Christian sharing ministries, which are essentially religious organizations. They come with some religious rules that come with them. They don't have a lot of the rules around insurance that does, but they are cheaper. You know, essentially the deal is they don't cover as much, but they cost less money. They're essentially a way out of some of the ACA rules about what has to be covered. They don't consider themselves insurance. You know, but people are looking for this. This has not worked for a lot of people, especially folks in certain ranges of income are really feeling like they did not get a good deal here.
Mike, thanks again for calling. We'll go now to Katie with us in Appleton. Katie, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Katie?
Yeah, I just wanted to weigh in. Your guest had been discussing before the high deductible plans and how that can really hit a family hard if there is a medical emergency. And I wanted to just do a little shout out to the HSA plans that go with those plans as an opportunity. My employer did a great job when we went to a high deductible plan of really encouraging us to take the difference in what we were paying in our premiums prior to the change and start investing that in the HSA plan. And our employer also contributed to the HSA plan, which was great. But I think that that's a great opportunity to take the highs and lows out. We had a medical emergency in our family this last year, and the HSA plan covered, you know, we had been able to save enough through that plan over the last couple of years that it really wasn't an issue for us at all.
Katie, thanks a lot for the call. So those health savings accounts in combination with the high deductible plan, she says, worked pretty well for her family, Drew.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is something you hear. An HSA can be a really, really great way of pairing with a high deductible plan. The problem with an HSA is you have to have money to put into it, or your employer has to put money into it for you. And if that's done and you do have money in there, you know, it works out great. I think some employers have looked at these things as saying, you know, while they're, you know, you can go and get an HSA, you're going to have to fund it yourself. I mean, what is going on here is that essentially you have healthcare costs rising and rising and rising, and employers are looking for ways to deal with that. And one of the ways that they have traditionally dealt with that is to say, we will buy something that is less expensive. We will cover less. And so you can put people in a high deductible plan and then not fund an HSA, which is one way of saving money and dealing with your healthcare costs as a company. Yes, it is definitely true that it's kind of a best practice. Having money in that account will save you the ups and downs. And, you know, if you don't use that money, you can roll it over to the next year. And you can really protect yourself from a lot of those risks. And unfortunately, that's not an option for everybody.
Thanks a lot for the call, Katie. Drew, since the Affordable Care Act passed, we've seen lots of efforts to repeal it. Have there been efforts, though, at the national level to say, okay, we've got this group, as you were saying, middle-class people who are kind of hurt here under the Affordable Care Act, and can we tweak the system as it exists to help them more?
Yeah, we're seeing the beginnings of some of those things. Short-term plans, which are coming back, the ability to buy essentially what is really, really skimpy insurance with a lot of limits. Those are, you know, they're now, I guess, there's no other way to describe them as saying they're long-term, short-term plans, so you can buy those for longer periods of time and use them as coverage. There's talk about association health plans. You know, again, These are kind of alternatives to the more protection providing coverage that is out there under ACA, and as in response, they are cheaper as well. I mean, that is, you know, the forever trade-off in healthcare insurance is essentially that you are going to get what you pay for, and what you're buying at the very high end tends to be super, super expensive. A lot of people would like the option of buying something that is not as comprehensive, that does not provide as many benefits, and frankly may leave them extremely exposed in the event of a severe illness or a major medical event. But it is something. And I think that there have been a lot of debates over the last decade about what is exactly the right amount of protection that we owe people on medical. And, you know, that's why you're seeing these questions right now about should we have Medicare for all? Should we have some kind of universal coverage? The ACA probably got part of the way there, but it also left some people in a difficult situation and asked them to pay quite a bit of money if they were going to get coverage.
We'll leave it there for now. Drew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me on.
That's Drew Armstrong with Bloomberg's U.S. Health News team. He was with us to talk about a year-long project there reporting on the challenges for Americans going without health insurance. Thanks for your calls as well and for sharing your stories. The series is called Risking It, Stories from America's Uninsured. You can find all those stories linked online at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new report finds that converting to renewable energy sources could create a lot of jobs here in Wisconsin. The authors of that report join the show to make the case. Most of us should probably eat more vegetables than we currently do. We'll find out how to make a vegetable-based meal that fills us up without having to find that protein to fill the void. And they're all around us. They make life easier. Sometimes they don't even do anything. The author of the new book, Power Button, takes a close look at the buttons in our lives from elevators to vending machines and beyond. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 6:30, UW System President Ray Cross joins the show for a look at the university's budget, possible changes in tuition, and other big issues facing UW campuses across the state. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, when you're young, you find yourself attending lots of weddings. When you're old, you might be at more funerals. We'll talk to a guest about how, despite the many losses we can experience when we're older, it can be a time to be our best self that we can be. She has advice on finding happiness as we age. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.